Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode.
We have to estimate, which is the same situation we've been in since 2009. So I'm reasonably confident in saying that Pogacar did that climb at 6.65, 6.7 watts per kilogram for the 16 minutes and 10 seconds of the climb. The real breakthroughs that like pull the curtain back are not coming from anti-doping, they're coming from police.
So it is the third podcast of the 2020 Tour de France on our Science of Sport podcast. And I have a little clip I want to play, which was part of our first podcast that we did two weeks ago. And here it is.
So just remind us what your podium was.
My podium, I didn't give you a podium, but I will now. I'll give you Pogacar, Bernal, Roglic. Okay. As my top three.
It's the same three people, but the order is different.
Except the order is different. So I'm putting it out there.
Right, so I'm going to claim that as a victory for the non-scientist in this Science of Sport podcast, Ross.
Tell us why. Tell us why you really chose Pogacar at that moment, please.
Well, I have to admit that I chose him largely because you chose Roglic, and I couldn't choose Roglic myself because there would have been no fun in that. And I guess to some extent I thought there was an outside chance, but if you had to commit money to it, I think I probably would have gone Roglic because it was very much a surprise that Pogacar won it in the end.
Yeah, especially by Saturday, because when we last spoke, well, when you made that prediction, very little had happened. It was week one. But even when we last spoke on the second rest day, Roglic hadn't yet opened up as big a lead. I think it was 40 seconds. It ended up 57, and your pick was looking less and less likely the closer we got to Paris. And then all changed on Saturday. It was quite an extraordinary day, I think. I thought Pogacar could win that time trial, but I didn't think he'd win it by even 15 seconds, let alone 57. I thought that Roglic, because he had the last guy advantage, he'd be getting the splits and the gaps to Pogacar. And I figured that in the initial, especially in that first period up to that first intermediate time check, which I think was at about 11K, I figured he'd be happy to concede a few seconds because Pogacar was going to go out hard and Roglic could measure his effort maybe a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Which is normally what happens when the yellow jersey goes last and can do that.
Yes.
He's done this in the past.
And the guy chasing him has to go for it. And there's more chance you're going to go too hard than not hard enough.
Yeah.
So I figured, okay, Roglic has lost. Okay, that was a bit more than I thought, but I figured he'd claw it back between the first and the second intermediate time check, and he didn't.
Mm.
So that was concerning. And then getting to the bottom of the climb, I think he had 26 seconds. And now you've got a bike change. You've got all those spectators. You wouldn't want to leave anything to chance or a technical, a slip chain or something. So at that point, you think, well, this is not a good day. Roglic is not – this is not going according to any plan. And then the moment he got on the climb, he just did not look like Roglic had looked for 3 weeks. He wasn't cratering. He wasn't imploding.
No.
And even the numbers we saw afterwards, estimates that they are acknowledged, still had him climbing at 6, and presumably he was at about 6 on the flat roads also coming
kilo,
in.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as though the guy just had a meltdown like some people in the past have had, but he just didn't look. I'd gone cycling with a friend of mine, Richard, that morning, and we were commenting that Roglic has looked so in control and he looked so compact and so solid on the bike. And for the first time, he looked like he was spinning and inefficient. And sure enough, that gap got smaller, smaller, smaller. And actually, in the end, it wasn't even close.
No, and I think the timing was the thing that got to everybody. I actually, and one of the discussions we're going to have today is I had the chance to talk to the head of the medical team for the UAE team, Jeroen Swart, who is a South African based here in Cape Town. And we're going to be talking a little bit about what he told me this morning. But one of the things he told me was that when they were looking at that morning, whether it was a possibility of Pogacar winning overall, they felt that it was absolutely a good chance because they'd seen that in the past Roglic hadn't done well in the last half of the race. Even though he'd done well on the climb on the Wednesday, there was a vulnerability with him in the second on the third week of a Grand Tour, which is what Chris Froome had actually said, that he predicted that Roglic was going to battle in the last week of the Tour. He might have only battled in the last 3 days of the Tour.
Well, 30Ks of the Tour, yeah. Really, because on the day that they went over and they finished, maybe there's that dust section. They didn't finish on it, but they went on that gravel section.
Yeah, he was going.
He actually looked like the strongest guy in the race, and he thought, okay, he's actually got this right. Because yes, he has in the past stumbled at some point in a three-week stage race.
Mm.
And if there was a doubt, and I mean, I know, like now we're Captain Hindsight sitting here. If there was a doubt about Roglic, it is that everyone has a bad day in the Tour de France. I mean, you're not going to ride for 21 stages and feel fantastic all the time. And his bad day wasn't dreadful, but it was bad enough that his 5% underperformance, coincident with some other guy to being 5% more than anyone maybe thought was possible, suddenly you've got this massive swing. And that changes the entire complexion of this discussion. Because I figured we'd sit here and talk about the Col de la Loze and the climb up and that, how interesting that was and so on. And now it's almost an afterthought. It's like it didn't even happen.
I mean, I'll be honest. When I was watching the tour on Saturday, I was on my indoor trainer. I thought, well, I'll watch the first bit and I'm pretty sure it's going to be a procession because a minute, you know, for those of you that don't watch a lot of cycling, a minute at the top end of that leaderboard going into a 30-kilometer time trial, as Ross has explained, is something that's usually quite insurmountable given the form of Roglic at the time. So what we saw on Saturday, and for those of you that are cycling fans that watch that Saturday stage, you will have realized it will go down in history as probably one of the most epic and historic stages, similar to Laurent Fignon and... forget his name now.
LeMond.
And LeMond back in 1989 when LeMond beat him by 3 seconds in the final time trial in Paris. So it was one of those classic moments where I think we'll look back in the history of the Tour de France and that will be one of them.
Yeah, and there was a while that it looked like it could be as close as that. And in the end, Roglic, I mean, he fell away by 3 seconds a K in the last five or six on the climb.
Yeah.
And more actually, because his climb time was considerably slower. I think Roglic was 11 fastest on the climb. And that tells you that he's not in a great day because there was no point in the preceding 3 weeks that Roglic looked like anything other than the second best guy in the race. You could say that in the first climbs in the Pyrenees on the Paris Sword and so on, Pogacar looked good, as good if not slightly better than Roglic. You never know because Roglic was managing the race at that point. So you never quite know if he was riding at 99% or 100%, whereas Pogacar had the deficit to make up from when he lost time in the winds.
And when he lost time in the winds, he lost a minute and a half.
It was, 120, I think it was.
Yeah.
So which actually, in the end, gave him a bit of license. He could then go on the attack, and he was on a longer leash than some of the other guys might have been. So that helped. And it also meant that he didn't have to have a team as much around him as he might have had otherwise. He could take the lead at the last possible moment, which was the perfect scenario for a team that had lost a couple of guys and didn't have, let's be honest, they didn't have the collective engine that Jumbo-Visma had. But what I was getting at really is that having never shown himself to be anything other than a top two guy, suddenly he's 11th. Now, that's not a good day for Roglic. And whether it's a case of a post-lockdown season 1 week too far, whether it's just because you do get bad days. I mean, you know, even we do. And when we have a bad day, we're just 5-10% off. These guys are 3-5% below. And we can talk a little bit on it because I know you've got some questions about the mechanical elements of their riding. And I think we'll come back to Roglic and what may be going wrong because the cadence is normally high. It looked higher than usual on the climb on Saturday. And he just didn't have watts. I mean, and this was, you know, sometimes time trials. The one you were mentioning there, LeMond Fignon, is often said to have come down to aerodynamics. Remember, because LeMond rode with a helmet. This wasn't
the time trial bars, actually. LeMond, it was the first.
Sorry, it was the time trial bars. Yeah, sorry, I thought it was the aero helmet. But you're right; they both had that, but it was the bars.
Yeah,
there was a story going around actually, just out of interest, where because he was in the yellow jersey, he can't wear his team's own suit. Yes. He's got to wear the. And apparently, Jumbo-Visma had invested a lot into a aerodynamic suit, which guys like Dumoulin and Wout van Aert would have worn, and he couldn't wear it.
Yes.
In the end, though, that's kind of a wash because neither could Pogacar. Also because he was in the white jersey.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at that, I mean, that's a factor. But I think in the end,
and there was also a problem with the. I haven't actually seen anything on this, but there was clearly a problem with his helmet, as if his helmet was too small. Because for those of you that watched it, as he was going up that climb, his helmet was kind of sitting on top of his head, like some sort of amateur mountain biker. And there was a story, even the commentators were saying that there was a problem with his helmet. He actually, in the post-race interview, said they asked him about his helmet and he didn't want to be drawn into that.
Mm.
But he sort of alluded to the fact that there was some issue with the helmet.
Yeah, it didn't look like thing. It fit well. And there was something – and it honestly reminded me – so the aforementioned friend has got kids who are learning to ride bikes, and it looked like when they put their helmets on, that's what Roglic looked like. Yes, it was sitting on the back of his head, you know. So as long as he falls backwards off the bike, he'd be okay. But any other direction and he's exposed.
Because he ripped off the visor, actually, when he changed bikes at the bottom of the climb at one stage, because he was wearing the visor. Then he ripped off the visor and threw the visor away. Obviously, he was just getting a bit hot in there.
Yeah.
But I was surprised he just didn't take the helmet off completely. But I suppose he couldn't. He wasn't legally allowed to. He had to wear the helmet.
So. Yeah, he wouldn't have been. So, yeah. But yeah, we could find little things here and there, you know. But in the end, this was not a race.
Marginal gains.
Right. And this was not a race decided by margins like that. This was just basically a 35-kilometer watt difference. That's what it was. And Pogacar just had more gunpowder in his legs than Roglic did. It was a straight-up – he was straight-up out-watted.
So let's talk about the numbers, because that is what everybody is talking about. What we do know is that Tadej Pogacar – Pogacar, I always get his name wrong.
Pogacar,
which actually is the correct spelling, the correct pronunciation. When I spoke to Drew this morning, I asked him how you say his name, and it is Pogacar.
Try again.
That's Pogacar. I'm getting it wrong again.
Pogacar.
No, it's not, but it's Pogacar. That's right.
Pogacar. Okay.
It's Pogacar. Sorry. Okay. Now I'm getting myself confused. My apologies. It's Pogacar, and I'll never say Pogacar again. That's the last time. But one of the things that we know is that he didn't have a power meter on his bike.
Yeah.
Druin was saying that the reason he wasn't sure why that had happened, but he suspects it's because the bikes were changed as they hit the bottom of that climb. So he went from his time trial bike onto the climbing bike. We know that, for instance, the equipment that the team from UAE is a stages equipment where they have a power meter sensor on the actual crank arm. And I know that in the past that has been an issue for some of the professional riders purely because those carbon crank arms don't work as reliably as if you've got an aluminium one. So there are issues in terms of reading. So potentially there was a reading issue. But we know he didn't have a power meter on, which doesn't give us – there's no power file that exists that we can't get hold of. It just doesn't exist. But what do we know about his power and his watts per kilogram doing that ride?
Well, we have to estimate, which is the same situation we've been in since 2009 and before. I only used 209 because that's when I started to look for this stuff in the first place, as I've said in our previous Tour de France wrap-ups. So the estimations are really the best we can do. You can, and the problem with estimations is inaccuracies because the estimate is based on the speed of the climb. And so there are different ways you can do this. There are calculators available online which allow you to enter the gradient, the distance, the time, and then they'll calculate, well, how much energy did it cost you to get from point A to point B given those input parameters? So in this case, we have a 5.8K climb with 505 meters vertical and 8.7 kilometers distance. That's that's the Strava segment, by the way, that I've been using. The trouble with that is that if you have a headwind or a tailwind, then your performance, i.e. what's on the stopwatch, changes even at the same power output. So tailwind blows you up faster, headwind slows you down. And as a result, you would overestimate the power for a tailwind situation and underestimate it for a headwind situation relative to what it actually should have been. So these things are fraught with difficulty. And that's why no matter what method you use, there's another one called VAM, which is what we'll get onto now.
Mm-hmm.
They've tried to correlate when because some riders make their data available, and I've got a few to talk about here. And you can correlate the VAM estimation to the actual, and you can say, okay, how well does VAM predict power or vice versa? What's the association?
Do you want to give us an explanation of VAM quickly?
Yeah, so VAM is vertical ascent meters. So if you're on a 1 kilometer climb per kilometer, let's say, and it climbs by 100 meters, so point B finish line is 100 meters vertically higher than point A, that's a 10% gradient. If you climb that in say 3 minutes, you've climbed 100 meters in 3 minutes, which means per hour, you'll climb 2,000 meters. And that's the VAM. So it's how many meters do you change vertically in 1 hour?
Okay.
Useful when you go hiking, because you know that the summit that you're trying to get to is at, I don't know, 3,150 meters, and you're starting at 2,000. So you know you've got 1,150 meters to go.
Yeah.
And you can count them down as you suffer up the altitude climb there.
Yeah. My VAM this morning was 450, I think, in one of the climbs. I was pretty impressed with that.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's contextualize that. So you can go to Strava and you can find Saturday's time trial, and you can find that segment on the final climb, 5.8Ks. And you will find that most of the elite guys are riding between 1,400 and 1,800 meters per hour vertically. So VAM obviously depends on your speed on the climb and the gradient. So if there's a steep gradient and you go fast, you're going to have a super high VAM. If there's a gradual gradient, no matter how fast you go, your VAM's lower. Yeah. Makes sense, right? Yeah. So the VAM, as I say, for the elite guys, Pogacar on Saturday was at 1,800 odd meters. I think it was 1,827. I'll tell you
exactly. That's for that climbing segment.
Yeah, so for his last 5.8, 1,873 meters per hour. Now, what an infamous doctor in cycling came up with is a formula that allows you to estimate the power output based on the VAM.
Ah, yes, Dr. Ferrari.
Yeah, the infamous Ferrari. Lance's coach, now yes. Serving a life ban. Most cycling listeners will know the name. And his formula was basically that you take the VAM and you divide it by a gradient factor, which is 2 plus the gradient of this climb, and then you can convert that to a watts per kilogram value. Okay, so if we do that for Pogacar on Saturday with that VAM and the gradient on that climb, you get 6.5 watts per kilo. The problem we've got now is we don't know how accurate that is for the conditions on the day. So again, unless you've got direct power output data, and even then, as you've alluded to, sometimes that's not even reliable.
Yeah,
you can't base everything on an estimate. But what we can do, and what I did, was I went on Strava and I found 15 cyclists who have uploaded their power output data. So, for instance, Leonard Kamner rode the climb in 17:38, which is a minute and a half about behind Pogacar. Mm-hmm. He's told us that his power on the day was 402 watts. That's his measured value. Thomas de Gendt rode it in 1801 at a power output of 415 watts. Connor Swift has data. Winner Anacona has data. Nicholas Roche has data. 1952 he did it in, and that's 369 watts for him. So what I did was I worked out...
And that's for the length of that last bit of the climb.
This is the 5K. It's the Strava segment of that climb, yeah.
Yeah.
So what I did was I worked out what their actual power output was and what their VAM calculated power output was according to the Ferrari equation. And I looked at the relationship between these. And they're more or less related, but not perfectly. Mm-hmm. Some guys, it overestimates by 2 or 3%. Other guys, it underestimates by 2 or 3%. But on average, for all 15 guys that I've looked at, the error is 1.2% underestimate. So basically what I've done here now, to make a long story short, is try to apply a corrective or calibration factor to VAM so that we can try and interpret Pogacar's number with a bit more confidence. Makes sense?
So we know what the conditions of we're getting close to what the conditions were like on the day.
Right, because all 15 of these cyclists finished within half an hour before Pogacar. So if the VAM estimate is inaccurate because of wind and so on, at least this kind of minimizes that inaccuracy.
Yeah.
So that number for Pogacar of 6.5 would then increase by 1.2%. It ends up being about 6.6 to 6.7. So I'm reasonably confident in saying that Pogacar did that climb at 6.65, 6.7 watts per kilogram for the 16 minutes and 10 seconds of the climb.
Which is exactly what Drun told me this morning. That's what they estimated it.
Happy days. I'm glad that. Yeah. I mean, so sometimes even a broken clock is, every day a broken clock is right twice a day.
Well, you guys are pretty close to the science here. So the fact that you concur on that.
Yeah. I think if you make cautious and informed assumptions in how you do that, I think you can actually get pretty close. People dismiss it as pseudoscience and whatever, but I think you can actually do it pretty well. And I'm glad to hear that this is reasonable. So I would say 6.6 to 6.7 on this climb.
Yeah.
There was a number circulating on the internet, Twitter. Johan Brunel mentioned it in his contribution to that Move podcast. And they were talking a number of 6.9. I can't, it's impossible for me that number could be that high.
Yeah. How would they have got to that number? Just not getting the science right, or just conjecture?
Well, I looked at the looked at some of the calculators that are available online. And listeners, you can go and search for power output calculator. There used to be one called Cycling Power Lab or something like that. And you can that's where you input Google your data. So how you get to that number, some of the input assumptions have to be too aggressive. Your bike has to be too light. Your rolling resistance has to be too large or something like that, because then you can inflate that number. So I don't believe that it's that high. If it just for interest's sake, if it were that high, like as it is, elite cycling always has an alarm bell in the background. It's like tinnitus in your ear, you know?
Yeah.
But if the number was that high for as long as it was, then that's like a siren going off.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we've spoken in the last two episodes about what the physiological implications are of these numbers and how we can interpret them in terms of our tension between confidence and skepticism around cycling. And we can get onto that now. But for me, the conclusion is that Pogacar climbed at about 6.6 to 6.7, which is extraordinary when you bear in mind that that comes at the end of a 40-minute flat time trial.
Yeah, and the end of 3 weeks of racing.
At the end of a three-week stage race, that has not exactly been a pedal, soft pedal around France.
It was one of the slowest average speeds of 38.8 kilometers an hour. 39.8 kilometers an hour for the entire route, but it was a hard stage since 2016.
Almost every climb they did was a record climb.
Yeah,
I mean, Pogacar now holds the fastest ever ascents on the Paris-Nord, the Marie Blanc, the Col de la Loze on Wednesday in the third week was a record. Obviously, it was a new climb. So of course, it was. That's foolish to say. Well, not brand new, but hardly done at this caliber before. To produce 6.6, 6.7 for 16 minutes off the back of what must be 6 watts a kilo for 40 minutes.
Yeah.
That's why there's skepticism. I mean, it is an astonishing performance, but you don't really need to know the power numbers to know that, because he beat the whole field by over a minute. I mean, the next best guys, who are pretty solid time trial guys and climbers, because you had Port, you had Tom Dumoulin, they were way behind. He destroyed
the
race.
He destroyed Dumoulin.
Yeah, I mean, it's and he was faster than Dumoulin on the flat.
Yeah.
And then he was over a minute faster on the climb. He was a minute faster than Port on the flat, and then 20-odd seconds faster on the climb. So no matter how you try and put that together, you have the best climber in the race doing the best flat time trial, or the best flat time trialist in the race doing the best climb. It's like that's what you call like total, complete domination. So then, of course, it's cycling. So complete domination equals what? You know, that's the situation we sit with now.
Well, that was the question I asked Jeroen this morning. I said, obviously, because of performances like that, the cynics come out and they say, well, you know, this is another Lance Armstrong type performance and this is just cycling. I said to him, how do you deal with that sort of criticism? And he was saying, well, if you look at the numbers, it's all pretty feasible. He has shown over the course of his career that he is an exceptional athlete. One of the things that they have in the UAE team that he stands by is if they're always taking a careful look at the biological passports of the cyclists and if there's any anomalies. And they had proven the last year they did pull somebody out, I think, out of the Vuelta because his biological passport was a little bit off. Turned out it wasn't an anomaly, and sadly he was pulled out of the race by management. So they're very strict about that, and he's very adamant that they are absolutely, you know, convinced of his achievements purely from a physiological point of view. The thing that he explained to me this morning was that Pogacar seems to have the ability to recover really well, but then his coach, who's the performance director, Inigo Saint-Millan, was talking about how he gets rid of lactate clearance.
The story there was
a tweet about that, wasn't there?
Yeah, and I think we can come back, because now that the tour's over, we've got for Pogacar, we've got estimates for his 16-minute performance at the end of a time trial, which, because one can make the argument that the 40 minutes before that are below his FTP or his maximal lactate steady state. Let's say it's 5.96 watts, and he could normally do 6.12, okay?
Yeah.
If these terms are making your eyes spin in your sockets, in their sockets,
I'm trying to keep up.
We've got an episode from a few weeks back, maybe a month or two, called What the FTP, where we try to explain all these concepts, because they really do inform this discussion. So go have a listen to that, but I will try and explain it again to you. We also know his 25-minute effort from the Paris-Nord. We know his 45-minute effort from the Colombier, I think it was. And then we know his 60-minute effort, because that's more or less, well, it was just 64-minute effort. That's how long it took them to get up the Col de la Loze. So I'll try and interpret what those mean. But the physiological context comes from this tweet that Inigo San Milan posted. His first tweet said that ever since he tested Pogacar for the first time in 2018, he saw that this was someone metabolically special. And someone on Twitter said, would you mind sharing with us one thing out of that test that jumped out at you? And he came back to his credit and he said that the difference, as you've said now, Mike, is the ability to clear lactate. When he rides at a high power output, his lactate levels are half those of other world tour cyclists. Now, why does this matter? I should actually ask you, because you've had a tutorial in this stuff for the last 6 weeks. So do you remember what the lactate threshold concept was?
Well, it's that turning point when your lactate sort of becomes overwhelming, but we know lactate is a fuel.
Yes.
So what's the question again?
So what the lactate threshold concept was is applied to performance. So when we talk about maximum lactate steady state and the ability to have a high power output with very low lactates, what does that signify?
Well, it means that you can push a higher wattage, I imagine, without the pain.
So it's not, remember, the lactate is not causing the pain. It's the flag that denotes the pain. So I used a pretty poor analogy at the time of, like, if you're walking through a field with landmines and they're all marked with little red flags, the red flag doesn't blow you up. The mine that it signifies blows you up. So lactate by itself is not the problem here. But once you start getting lactate accumulation, so the level of lactate goes up and up and up and up, fatigue is not following soon, not far behind it.
Right.
Okay. So lactate is almost a marker of what your metabolic status is. And the reason that matters is because when we exercise, our bodies are breaking down carbohydrates and fats. If the rate at which we break those fuels down, specifically now, carbs, we're taking glycogen and glucose and we're oxidizing it. If that's happening too fast for our capacity, there's a spillover, and that spillover is lactate. Yeah?
Yeah.
So when you see an elite athlete in any endurance sport, you'd find the same characteristic for runners and cross-country skiers as you would for cyclists. When they are able to go at a very high intensity with low lactate, what it's telling you is that they've got a metabolic or a biochemical system that is really good at avoiding that spillover. And so I'm reasonably confident in saying that Pogacar did that climb at 6.65, 6.7 watts per kilogram for the 16 minutes and 10 seconds of the climb. We discussed oxidative versus aerobic or anaerobic, if you wish to use the now outdated terminology. Mm-hmm. So in actual fact, if you were to ask what a characteristic of an elite top level endurance athlete would be, I would have guessed that it would be high levels, high power outputs, or high exercise intensity with low lactate, because they are so good at avoiding the accumulation of lactate, because A, they don't produce it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like if you've got, you're sitting here drinking from a 500 milliliter bottle. If I try and fill that bottle at 1 liter per minute, within 30 seconds, there's spillover.
Yeah.
The only way I can avoid that spillover is I can slow the rate that I'm pouring the water into it down, mm-hmm. but you don't want to do that because now you're going to be at the back of the race, or I need a bigger bottle.
Yeah,
and that's what we're saying, is that Pogacar has got this massive bottle. So he doesn't get spillover. He doesn't get accumulation of lactate because he doesn't produce it as quickly. And then the other thing elite athletes do is they metabolize their own lactate. And that's what lactate clearance means. So they might produce it in relatively high volumes, but they're also able to turn it. And you just alluded to it, is they can take that lactate and then re-oxidize it elsewhere. So they can actually use it as a fuel source.
Okay.
The net result.
And is this genetic or trained?
It's both.
Okay.
And so an element of it is genetics. So genetics would set the ceiling. Some people, irrespective of how much they train, will not achieve the level of lactate clearance and therefore the low lactate levels. And remember, in fact, when we did the FTP episode, I'd sent you an email and I chucked all sorts of acronyms and abbreviations, MCT1s, MCT4s, those are the molecules that are responsible in part for this lactate clearance and this lactate shuttle. I'm not going to go into detail now. Listen to that if you want to know.
Yeah.
But the end result is that when you look at a guy like this riding at 400 watts, his lactate levels are very low because his biochemical or his metabolic system is so well equipped to deal with energy flux and demand.
Yeah,
that he doesn't produce lactate, and as a consequence, he doesn't produce all the other things associated with lactate that then cause fatigue, hydrogen ions, phosphate ions, that sort of stuff. Makes sense.
Which means that what Jeroen was talking about, his ability to recover, is then increased?
Possibly, but that would be from like an acute effort.
Yeah.
What I think what he's alluding to there, I don't know, he said it to you, is you've been on the bike for 4.5 hours, the last hour of which was really hard on Wednesday. Mm. You got to do that again on Thursday. Friday may be a little bit easier, but it's still, you're not exactly sitting on the couch.
No.
Saturday, you've got to go super hard for 57 minutes to an hour. So daily, I mean, we don't even train at anything like this level, but if you layer 5 or 6 good rides, hard rides, one after the other, by the weekend, your legs are knackered. Mm. That's because we're not recovering very well.
To some extent,
and actually,
yeah.
Like the whole point of doping is to improve recovery, actually, like testosterone, growth hormone stuff, they accelerate recovery. So it is a key element of performance.
So do you think, I mean, just sort of wrapping up the discussion about his physiology, is that a significant enough differentiator between him and the rest, or is it just a combination of lots of things?
Conceptually, it's not a differentiator, because if you ask anyone in the world who works with endurance athletes, they will tell you that a prerequisite to be an endurance champion is the ability to have a high power output with low lactate levels, because they're, and again, it's not about the lactate, it's about what the lactate says about the underlying biochemistry. This is a person who has an enormous oxidative capacity. They have so many little mitochondria that they can just deal with unbelievable energy demands without the suffocation or the noose of fatigue pulling them back. Yeah.
So all of those guys in the Tour de France peloton will have a very high level.
Certainly,
of that.
Certainly the top 30 cyclists in the world will be exceptional. And you would, I don't know what the metric would be, but let's say it's lactate levels. If you took them and you took 1,000 people at random from around the world, they would be clearly, clearly different.
Mm.
The question here really is one of magnitude, not concept. Is he that much better than a World Tour cyclist? Now, who's he being compared to? Is he being compared to Jerome Cousin, who didn't finish the hard stage, I think, on the Col de la Loze and eliminated out of the time? Because he's a great cyclist. He's a World Tour guy. He was in breaks and he's good. But he's not Bernal. He's not Roglic. He's not pick your winners from the last 20 years, you know? So as a question of scale, I don't know. And that's why it would be cool to know. But the implication of it is that if you can ride at 400 watts with almost no lactate or very low levels, you can ride at 420 before it starts to come up. Mm. That sets your FTP. Literally, that's the definition. Your maximal lactate steady state is what's the highest power output you can ride at before your lactate levels start to go up and fatigue follows soon after.
Because essentially what he was doing on Saturday was performing an FTP test.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's probably because, and you know how it is, if you want high power outputs, you go uphill. It's much easier to, so it's not a steady FTP, but it's basically an hour where the first 40 minutes is at 90% and the last 15, 20 minutes is going to be at 100% of it. So, or beyond it, actually. It's 95 and 105. I don't know.
Yeah.
And that's the big question about that performance is I don't know how to interpret those last 16 minutes in the context of the whole 57, because it's not, you see, Pogacar didn't do a Carapaz on the day.
Yeah, so let's talk about Richard Carapaz, because he's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Because just to give some context to this, the discussion, Richard Carapaz, of course, contesting for the King of the Mountains jersey. So his strategy was to go into the bottom of the climb relatively easy, then to nail the climb as hard as he could, because the actual climb was the points for the mountain, the King of the Mountains jersey. And of course, Pogacar was his biggest competitor.
Yeah.
So the
he had to finish above him. If he finished above Pogacar, he wins polka dots.
Yes. Yeah. So he has to beat him on that climb.
Yeah, on the climb.
So we knew that Pogacar was obviously going to go hard right from the gun. Carapaz was going to take it easy. Pogacar drills him on the climb, despite having ridden pretty hard. And what was the difference between them?
I'm just looking now. So Pogacar 16:10, which is obviously the fastest climb. Carapaz manages to do the seventh fastest climb in 17:22, so a minute and 12.
Yeah, I mean,
and Carapaz, by the way, when we say he went slowly to the bottom, he was the second slowest guy in the whole race.
So he really was taking it easy.
I mean, it's not like he's not riding at 2 watts a kilo, but he's probably going 4.5, which for these guys is like steady warm-up material.
Yeah.
And then he's thrashing it for 17 minutes, and he's still getting buried by a minute.
Absolutely.
It's amazing to think.
I know. And we were actually sitting there WhatsApping each other on Saturday saying, I wonder if how Carapaz is doing. But it wasn't even close.
Yeah.
Pogacar was on, and he was on every part of that route.
So, I mean, imagine Carapaz had to go hard from the beginning. I mean, he, how much – and this is what I don't know – is how much would Carapaz have paid on the climb if he'd had to spend more on the flat?
Yeah.
So let's say he'd gone 30th fastest instead of 149th. I don't know how many guys rode that stage. But let's say he'd really gone for it on the flat. Yeah. Maybe a minute slower on the climb. Now you're talking about a two and a half minute gap to a guy who won the Giro. And Carapaz is, okay, I don't think he's at the level he was when he won that Giro. But it's still, it just puts into context again how remarkable that performance was, you know. But it's a confusing, difficult one to interpret. And sadly, and this comes back to what you learned from during this morning, is you say, well, we can trust the numbers. But what numbers? The ones we have to estimate and guess, the 6.9, which I think is too high, the 6.6 that I've estimated, but I don't know how that 6.6 fits into the 57, because what was it, 6.1 for 40 or was it 5.7? Because that could change it.
Yeah.
What is the maximum lactate steady state? Like, I would imagine for Pogacar it's 6.1 to 6.2. So for a fresh 45 to 60 minutes, he could probably do 6.1, 6.2.
Yeah.
It's impossible, but we've got other performances for Pogacar, also, unfortunately, estimates. You know, so we know that his 25-minute performance was 6.5. We know that his 45-minute performance was around 6, plus minus, I'd say, 2 to 3%. And we know that his 60-minute performance was 5.8. And I tried, by the way, to adjust for altitude, because that 60-minute performance finished at 2.3, 2,300 meters. And you've got to make that adjustment. So, I mean, without laboring the explanation again, because there's a physiological ceiling beyond which we can't perform, we can start to make inferences about what the underlying physiology is to create these performances. Yeah. VO2 max, threshold ability, and cycling efficiency. Those are the three inputs. A plus B plus C equals performance. And so for what I've got here for these durations and these intensities, at an efficiency of 24%, which is high. So typical for cyclists is 22 to 23, but an efficiency of 24%, Pogacar's VO2 max estimate is about 84. If he's less efficient, that VO2 max goes to 87, 88, 89. If he's inefficient, we're talking low 90s, okay? Now, none of those
I know we talked about this in what the FTP podcast, but just give us a brief description of how do we see efficiency? What's the easiest way to describe efficiency?
So you measure how much energy the body is using to cycle, and you do that via oxygen levels at the mouth. So this is indirect calorimetry. So that I'm sure listeners will have seen pictures, either a cyclist or a runner wearing a gas mask and either a bag or a fancy newer machine. Mm. And that thing's measuring VO2 and CO2 levels and breathing rate and all sorts of things. And VO2 is the key one.
Yeah.
Because we know that when we are exercising at various intensities, every liter of oxygen we burn produces a given amount of energy, okay? So if I'm cycling at, say, 6.5 watts per kilogram, like we're assuming Pogacar was doing for that 25-minute effort, that works out for him to be 429 joules per second, given his mass. At the mouth, we would be measuring what's happening there, and if he was 23% efficient, his oxygen consumption at that moment, riding at 6.5 watts per kilogram, would be 80 mils per kilogram per minute.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And you can push this up or down using certain assumptions. I've made the best case assumptions for the lowest possible VO2 to give the benefit of the doubt to the rider. Okay.
Yeah.
So
how nice of you.
Yeah. Well, you have to, because otherwise people will climb on your head for making false unfair assumptions. So this is based on the assumption that every liter of oxygen is going to provide 5 calories, just over 5 calories. It means that for him to ride at 429 joules per second, watts, his actual energy cost would be 1,865, and the actual VO2 at that point would be 80. Now, it's known that these guys can probably sustain 90 to 95% of max for 25 minutes. Therefore, the VO2 max that you calculate turns out to be, I'll tell you now, 89 mils per kilogram per minute.
89,
which is
high.
Super high. I mean, it's incredibly high.
Yeah.
If he's more efficient, by definition, it means that he's using less oxygen to do a given workload. He's getting more bang for his buck, as it were.
Mm.
Then his VO2 max is 84.
So you have to assume that he's relatively efficient.
Yeah, you're going to assume that like the best endurance guy in the world is going to have a relatively good efficiency combined with a high VO2 max. Now, I've said before, and I stand by it, there comes a point at which a performance becomes physiologically impossible, mutant, alien, ridiculous, outrageous.
We've heard those words a lot in cycling, unfortunately.
Yeah, even to describe that performance innocuously, innocently, but that's what people do.
Yeah.
Lance said, unbelievable performance. Well, Lance, like you might not want to use that adjective. So anyway, long and short of it is that if Pogacar is 24% efficient, which is high, riding at these estimated power outputs for these durations, VO2 max estimate is 84.
Which is?
If he's less efficient, VO2 max is higher. If he's more efficient, VO2 max goes down. If his ability to ride at a high power output goes up, according to Inigo, that might be the thing, then the VO2 max comes down a little bit that you estimate. So there's play in this, and that's why you don't want to. And but again, if these data exist from the time that he was tested in 2018, so it's as a 20-year-old, they would contextualize and reassure people about what they're seeing at least.
Mm.
And it's easy for me to sit here and say it, but I would if I'm the athlete and that's who I am, I'd tell people.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not going to help Bernal beat me.
Yeah,
so.
I guess to some extent, as you've heard in the past, that. I think Lance and his podcast, which we always say is the second best podcast on the internet, where they talked about how they wouldn't share their power data back in the day. I mean, probably for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons why they didn't want to let too much of the information out to their competitors.
Yeah.
So there's a competitive element to it, which I suppose is a fair argument. But for people like yourself, if you're in that space, you can probably work it out anyway.
Yeah, and so, even if you couldn't, you still have a stopwatch.
Yes.
And so now you know that if you can't climb 5.8K at 8.7% in 16 and a half minutes, Pogacar is beating you.
It's beating you.
And it actually doesn't matter if it's 405 watts or 445 watts. The point is that you are still slower than he is.
Yeah.
So irrespective of how you express it, I can't see that knowing the performance outcome changes it. I get the argument around training data. Like you don't want to tell people how you've trained because that is a potential source of a large competitive advantage. But when people know your power data in the race, it's irrelevant. It's such a weird secrecy thing that doesn't help. And again, cycling needs to do, in my opinion, as much as possible to push back against secrecy, not embrace it even more, especially in races. Because I mean, and also, if you don't give it to people at six, let's say it's legitimately 6.6, and my estimate is accurate, and Juren said that as well.
Yeah,
the whole world's discussing this as though it's 6.9.
Yeah,
what would you rather, Pogacar?
Especially go, you're like Johan Bernal says it.
Yeah,
then it becomes now, gospel. Yeah,
if it's 6.6 and not 6.9, that changes the conversation because 6.9 for 16 minutes at the end of a 40-minute time trial, well, a 57-minute time trial, that starts to get into the area where it does become biologically implausible because you would need ridiculous efficiency or VO2 max or a combination of those two things in order for that to become plausible. So I know some people say it's rubbish that you can identify an impossible performance based on this, but it's not. It's just that where they are now is right up against that limit. But there'll come a point at which it gets just stupid. I mean, what Bjørn Riis and those guys were doing in the late 90s in the absence of any doping regulations, because they couldn't test blood transfusions, they couldn't look for EPO. I mean, it was a free-for-all.
Mm.
They were doing 6.6 for 45 minutes. Now we're talking VO2 max in the high 90s, or you're riding at 95% of your VO2 max for 45 minutes.
What was Pintani? He was at one of the climb was 7 or something.
Allegedly 7. Anyway, so eventually you cross over from crazy human performance to actually just like aliens have invaded Earth performance. But see, here we sit and we have every intention of trying to be accurate. Why must we guess? Like, I should just, anyway, I've just been saying for 11 years now, like tell people.
Yeah.
And some people will still say it's stupid, but there's going to be people who are currently in the gray who you might actually convince otherwise. And make it available. It would garner, I think, more trust than letting people guess at 6.9 would.
So one of the news stories that's come out of the Tour de France after the day after the actual finish on Sunday, which actually was Pogacar's birthday, by the way, his 22nd birthday, was that one of the teams, Samsic Kaya, were raided. And, of course, that was on the Wednesday before the end of the Tour itself, which, of course, this is Nairo Quintana's team. Again, it casts aspersions over the rest of the Tour and, again, creates even more drama on a really dramatic race already.
Yeah, I mean, cycling does what cycling does, and we thought we'd got through the Tour with only speculation and questions about performances. But as I've been at pains to point out for 2 weeks now, we can discuss these performances and we can talk about what they mean and why there's doubt and suspicion. But the number, you know, whether it's 6.5 watts a kilo or whether it's an implication at 84 mils per kilogram of oxygen, those things by themselves don't really grow the doubt. But what grows the doubt is this stuff. So. Yeah. You know, and this has been ever present for cycling from when I started watching it in the 90s, and then we had Festina, then we had Lance, then we had Landis, then we had Operation Puerto at the same time as Landis. Mm. We've got Operation Adelas going on in a trial right now.
You and Jeroen were actually, just as a complete side story, you and Jeroen were actually not involved in Operation Puerto, but you were supposed to be there to look after Jan Urich at the time. The Operation Pietro happened and you guys just basically rode around Europe for the next few weeks because you couldn't be at the Tour.
We got spat out of our first shot at it. So now Jeroen's made it there. I never did, and I don't think I ever will. But the story was that Urich used to come to Cape Town every year with his team to train in the summer, our summer, their winter. And he came to the Institute in 2005 towards the end of the year.
Sports Science Institute in Cape Town.
Yes, thanks. Yeah. And we started doing some work with him. We tested him and they were sufficiently impressed to invite us to come join them. So we flew out separately, but we were going to meet the team on the first rest day in Po. Yeah. And we'd booked our flights and everything. And then literally like 2 days before, I forget, but the whole team had been kicked off because of the Puerto scandal with Fuentes, and Urich was implicated in it. So we had this trip booked and I was like, well, I'm just going to go and have a holiday. And I just didn't even... I ended up following a little bit of the Tour. I saw the Alpe d'Huez stage where Landis lost time. I saw Landis's superhuman effort to win that yellow jersey. But mostly I just ended up drinking beers in French pubs with Australian backpackers, thanks to Fuentes.
And you rode around with Jeroen a bit, didn't you?
No, we ended up going our separate ways because he had lots of mates who were following the Tour. And I just said, well, I've seen a lot of the places because I'd done the Tour in 4 and 5. Yeah. And I thought, well, let me just do this as a holiday. Yeah. So that was my...
So anyway, so going back to this Arkea... Samsic team. Right. I mean, the thing is that so they have been raiding their hotel rooms, but they probably had a pretty miserable tour. So obviously, if they were guilty of something, they were taking the wrong stuff.
Well, and whatever led to the police raid wasn't their performances, that's for sure. So that must have been. You can only imagine it's a tip off.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Then the police get involved, and I don't.
We don't know what the outcome of the raid was anyway yet.
I don't even know if we will. You know, apparently I read this. I can't even remember it. But Quickstep were raided last year.
Yeah.
I don't even remember that.
I don't remember that, no.
But it's a kind of like, it's like a shadow that cycling has and you can never escape it, you know. Mm. So, yeah, we had Fuentes. Now Adelas is going on. As I said, now there's this one. And this is the background. So this is the canvas on which the power output numbers exist. And that's why it's so difficult to believe because you'll see what will happen. My prediction will be that nothing will happen here. There's going to be smoke and mud and whatever because now they've taken the doctor and a masseuse into custody, I believe, and they were questioned. They questioned Quintana. They allegedly found medical products and methods that could be doping methods. That could involve IV, you know, and there's a no needles policy in the sport. So I suspect it's going to be a lot of smoke and mirrors again, allegation, insinuation, but nothing clean. And that's the problem. It's the same for all these endurance sports. There have been raids on hotels in track and field where they found literally EPO and pharmacy supplies worth of drugs and still no athletes have been implicated in that. I mean, how much cleaner do you want it to be?
Yeah.
So it's demoralizing. And again, the problem is it's not coming from anti-doping. I mean, maybe the tip-off
French authorities,
maybe tip-off was from anti-doping, but it ends up being a police thing.
Yeah.
And it's investigations and stuff. And that's why I'm so skeptical when people say, we monitor the anti-doping passport data and we do. I've seen data from some distance running athletes who've subsequently been done for doping where they've known for years that this guy was doping and they couldn't nail it down.
Yeah.
And eventually he has to make such a bad mistake in order for it to be a clean doping case that you actually think, How does anyone ever
fail? Oprah gets him.
Oh, well, yeah, but even that, like, how did he go down? It wasn't anti-doping.
I suppose from...
Because it was whistleblowers and it was allegations and testimonies and grand jury subpoenas. That's how it happens.
Yeah. Travis Taggart.
I mean, Fuentes was not... So anti-doping contributes. I don't want to pretend like it's non-existent, but the real breakthroughs that, like, pull the curtain back are not coming from anti-doping. They're coming from police and financial... Police stopping a car at the border kicked off the Festina scandal. Not anything. Anyway, it's just...
Yeah.
So that's why it's so difficult to remain hopeful.
We look at these. We look at these performances, and for those of you that love cycling, and I'm sure most of you listening probably do like we do, is that we can't ignore the fact that there is this shadow that hangs over cycling. And, you know, anytime there's an outstanding performance like that, there is always that suggestion that there is... some sort of stuff going on behind the scenes. So we have to tackle these subjects, unfortunately. It's just one of those things in cycling. And, you know, full disclosure, both Ross and I very know a lot of the medical team involved with the UAE team at the moment. And, you know, we're certainly very hopeful that nothing untoward will come out of that team at all. And we certainly hope that Pogacar's performance was very legit. And I'm a bit of a fan of his because I think he rides with a sort of an abandon, which I really love. He's an aggressive rider and seems to be a great guy to work with as well. Let's just talk a little bit about some of the mechanics here. Now, Ross and I have had a debate over our WhatsApp. If you can see our WhatsApps at about 10:30 at night sometimes, I don't think we ever sleep. I was throwing out the idea that Pogacar was first of all taller, which he isn't. He's actually a centimeter shorter than
Roglic. It's funny that actually, because I also would have thought he was.
I thought he was too. Yeah. I thought he was a tall guy. He's not.
Yeah.
I was throwing out the idea that because he had maybe potentially longer legs than Roglic, that the climb suited him because he could push out more power. And he was clearly going up that climb at a slower cadence than Roglic was going up, which then fed into my theory that a power climber like Pogacar was more suited to that climb up La Planche de Belfi. So is there any, first of all, I sent you a couple of studies by the British Journal of Sports Medicine. Unfortunately, they were from 1989 and not many people are in them. But is there any basis for looking at a power climber who's riding at a slow cadence versus somebody that's a high cadence rider? Because in the days of Lance Armstrong, everybody was talking about high cadence. Now you're seeing a lot of riders like Pogacar who don't ride with a particularly high cadence, but seem to power more. Is there any suggestion that one is better than the other, or does it just seem to be style now?
Well, I think, okay, so like I said, I also thought Pogacar was taller. He's not. So your theory that he might have longer limbs might be the reason why we both thought he is, because you do get guys who are just like elongated in the limbs, you know, distal elongation. And that is actually a quality that distance runners have to have. It's almost a prerequisite to be a world-class distance runner, is you have to have disproportionately long legs relative to your torso. Whereas, interestingly, to be a good swimmer, it's the other way around. You want short legs and a long torso. And so David
looks like some sort of cartoon character because his legs are quite short.
Really. Yeah, it looks like a human stretching rack, caution and tail, but only on the top half. Whereas, so David Epstein, who's we've spoken to on the pod, wrote the best sports science book you'll read. It's called The Sports Gene. And there's a chapter in that book in which he discusses body types in sport. And I actually contacted him when you asked me, because I thought, well, let me go straight to the expert here. Mm. And he dug up a whole bunch of stuff and sent them to me, but there's so much, I haven't looked at it yet. But in his book, he tells the story of Phelps and Hisham Al-Garouj, who's the world record holder in the mile. Apparently, they wear the same length pants, even though Phelps is something like 18, 20 centimeters taller than Al-Garouj. So whatever height difference they have is entirely because Phelps has a long upper body. So you've got long upper body, short legs is the swimmer, short upper body, long legs is the distance runner. So you're certainly born to do certain things. The constraint in cycling is the pedal, the crank. So you've got this revolution thing. And there's a trade-off between longer cranks and faster pedal speeds. Right. So in order to achieve, so longer cranks require faster pedal speed in order to move 360 degrees. It's like you
slower pedal speed, surely. If you've got longer cramps, you're pedaling slower, are you not?
No, because you end up doing that, but to have the same cadence.
Right.
So it's like if I was running on the inside lane of a track and you were running on the outside, you're the long crank, I'm the short crank. If we both have to complete the lap in 1 minute, you actually have to run faster than me because you've got further. Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay, right.
So long cranks require faster pedal speed, angular velocity of the pedal, and that comes at a cost. So what tends to happen is guys with longer cranks have a lower angular velocity, but because of the length of the lever arm, the crank, they can exert higher torque. Mm-hmm. And power is torque times velocity, right?
Right.
You with me?
Yep.
So in the end, there's a trade-off between torque and velocity, and one goes up with long crank.
Velocity is the speed of the pedal going around.
Yeah, so it's angular velocity. So we express that in radians per second. Right. How many radians does that thing cover per second?
Radians per second. I'm making notes.
Good. I'll test you in 6 weeks, like the lactate test. So where was I? So there's a trade-off.
Yeah.
Longer cranks, higher torque, lower angular velocity.
Right.
Shorter cranks, lower torque, but better angular velocity. So in the end, there's actually not much evidence that like crank length makes a difference.
It could just be style and preference.
Yeah. So in the end, and I mean, as the editor of a magazine, you know, like what's your advice whenever you cover the subject?
Yeah. Ride comfortably.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I mean, we know that, for instance, and I'm sure you're going to tell us about a piece of research that you saw that talking about this idea that if you don't ride at 90 revolutions per minute as a cadence, which is something really heavily used in cycling terms, is that if that's the most efficient sort of cadence. But in my experience and having advised a lot of people in cycling, that's quite difficult to ride at 90 unless you're a really good rider.
Mm.
And sometimes trying to push that high revs is sometimes counterproductive.
Yeah, so there's a study that was published in 2019 towards the end of last year, so maybe a year ago, where they got a bunch of recreational cyclists, and not by any means world tour level guys like we've been speaking about, but recreational guys, and they make them cycle. And it's a fairly basic study. I would like it to be maybe a bit more in depth, but maybe next time, the next evolution of it. Mm. And they make them ride at 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, and 90 RPM. That's your cadence. 40 is super slow. I mean, you'll feel like you're
grind.
It's, I mean, that's properly grinding. And then 90 is what most, it's almost like conventional wisdom, right, these days. In the tour, I'd be surprised if many in that front pack are not in the mid to high 90s.
Yeah, I looked at a lot of the cadences. They're all 85, 90 plus average on every stage and often at peaking at 120.
Yeah, and I would imagine it would be interesting to go back, but Roglic in that time trial was over 100, pretty sure. Pogacar was probably in the mid 90s. So it's a 5 to 10% difference. But anyway, back to the study. What they'd measured is VO2, heart rate. They were able to measure oxygen saturation in the quad muscle. You know, that's the main driver. And obviously, as you exercise, you desaturate. There's less oxygen in your quads. Mm-hmm. And what they found is that when the guys rode at 90 RPM, their heart rate was higher, their VO2 was greater, their oxygen desaturation was greater. In other words, they were more desaturated. Their efficiency was lower. And so the conclusion was that at those high cadences, you actually become less efficient, and it's probably not advisable. But it clearly is advisable for a professional, because I've got this Darwinian approach to sport that I've brought up before, is pros figure out what works and then it persists. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't persist. It dies. It's a survival of the fittest, survival of the best method. And so what they do generally is the best thing for them. And so if riding at 70 RPM was the way to go, they'd have done it.
Yeah,
but they're riding at higher cadences because and this is the amazing thing, is you think cycling is a basic activity, doesn't need skill. But if you ever see an elite cyclist up close, they actually move the pedals in a way that makes you realize that they're quite skillful.
Beautiful. Yeah.
It really is different to watch.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same thing. I mean, it's even more obvious when you watch. I remember watching elite high jumpers warming up, and they were doing hurdles drills and stuff. And I was like, I could do that, but I don't look like that.
Exactly.
I mean, okay, and some stuff I can't do either, but a lot. But I can jump over a hurdle. But they jump over a hurdle. They got something about them that is hard to pin down, but it's there. And it's the same. The aforementioned Ulrich, when we put him on a stationary bike in a laboratory, he moved the thing as though it was a different machine. I'd never seen that before up close.
And they call it in French souplesse, which is literally translated means agility and suppleness. But it's a great way to describe how a very nice pedaling action looks amongst a pro rider. And sometimes you can literally be riding behind somebody on your Sunday rider and you can see somebody that has a good pedaling style for those of you who love cycling.
Yeah.
And there's a great story about Maurizio Fondries, former world champion, who used to spend hours in front of a mirror trying to perfect his pedaling stroke so it looked good. That was his main thing. Souplesse and how he looked was very important. And there are some riders, and most of those riders in the Tour de France, except for Bilbao, have amazing souplesse.
Yeah.
And they just look the part.
They do. And even when they don't, I mean, they're still, what they're doing at the pedal is different from what you and I do. Yeah. The smoothness of that stroke and the muscular, the coordination. I mean, it's coordination is what it is, you know. Exactly. And again, on that, on my, well, it wasn't just that trip, but on my eventually ill-fated trip to France in 2006, I remember sitting on Alpe d'Huez waiting for the race to come through and all the recreational guys are riding. And every 100th guy, doesn't matter how slowly he's going, you can say that that guy or that woman is good.
Yeah.
And it's not because of how fast they go, it's because how they look doing it.
Yeah.
And that's, so pros have coordination and they acquire that over the course of 10,000 kilometers a year average from the time they're teenagers. And think about how many million pedal strokes they've practiced to get that ability and compared to what we do. So anyway, so that's where cadence comes from. So back to your question is, a taller person can pedal a longer crank because they've got longer levers with which to do it, but it doesn't end up giving them an advantage. And that's also, remember that a tall guy is going to be heavier. You can't get length without mass.
Compare with that one.
And right, because you're
192 and 95 kilos.
Yeah. So so with elongation comes mass. And so we know that cycling mass is the enemy. So it's not a surprise that everyone in the top 10 in that, okay, Dumoulin's probably the tallest. Wout van Aert's pretty tall.
He's a fat guy at 77 kilograms, all Wout van Aert, isn't he? Relatively speaking.
And that's
heavier than Lance.
Yeah. And that's, again, not to drag it back to where it came from before, but that's where now you've got a guy who's that big, that tall, low altitude native, and we're in the altitude on the heavy climbs over 20 Ks at 8-9%, and he's shelling climbers. And everyone says, well, how's this? This defies what we think we understood about cycling. And that's part of the problem, you know? So it's the skinniness, it's the power despite the mass and the skinniness of some of the, anyways. So
I'm going to ask you to finish off with your sort of three takeouts from this year's race. But let's just, before we just go there, let's just talk about the young riders. You've mentioned Wout van Aert now. A classics rider, unbelievable domestique on the climbs, winning stages. I mean, he had probably the best start to a cycling season in the history of cycling. He won in a whole bunch of races before the Tour de France itself.
Yeah.
But there are this new generation of athletes coming through. Do you think we're ever going to see the Froomes and the Geraint Thomases coming back, or are those days over now?
No, I mean, I say no, but I mean, Thomas might win the Vuelta, but it's not it's not a strong Vuelta this year compared to what we've seen now in the last 3 weeks. But I can't see that. I think that we're clearly at a generation watershed now.
Yeah.
And the new generation is younger than any generation before, which in itself is interesting. It's one of, and you said, I mean, this is one of my three scientific take-homes or key
stories. Well, let's go with that first one then.
Well, the first one we've covered is the doping question, you know, like this trust, the cynicism, the performance, which is always the thing in the tour. I love doing it. It doesn't clarify anything really, but it's cool. The second one is the young rider thing. So it's interesting because the conventional wisdom in cycling was that you had to earn your stripes. Not your rainbow stripes, but you earn your colors, you know. And then that took 4 or 5 years. You'd come into a team as a young 20, 21-year-old. You'd ride some of the smaller races. They wouldn't throw you into the Tour till you're 24, 25. Then you'd be a young rider.
Mm-hmm.
You'd earn a couple
That's
of Tour de France.
Competition.
Exactly, at that cutoff.
Yeah.
You'd earn your sort of experience and your palmares in smaller races. You'd get a couple Tours under your belt finishing in the second half of the race. You'd ride the bus every day on the climbs. And by the time you're 28, 29, you could start maybe looking. That was always the formula.
Mm.
Now you've got guys, Hershey, you've got obviously the race winners, the second youngest guy ever.
Yeah.
And I mean, the last one is 104.
1904.
It's crazy. You've got, you mentioned Van Aert, you mentioned his teammate was Sepp Kuss, young guy, first tour.
Yeah. Carapaz is relatively young, isn't he? 23, 24.
Yeah. And Lopez was the second guy on the young rider classification.
Yep.
I mean, so now you've got guys in their first tours or second, winning not just the white jersey, but the whole thing.
Yeah.
Being the key domestiques. So something's clearly different, and it's interesting to wonder what that is.
They have a jersey for the old category.
Yeah, they're going to have to replace it. Like, who's the fastest 32-year-old or something?
Between Port and Valverde.
Yeah, well, you're going to have a 75-plus jersey for Valverde.
Yes.
So it's really interesting to wonder why that is. And I think part of it might be, and I've got this theory always in anything in sport, it takes 4 or 5 generations to change something. Because the first generation, it starts the change. They stuff it up usually. The second generation, it starts to take hold. The third generation figures out how to do it. And by 4 generations, it's embedded.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether if we go back, because a generation for me is 6-7 years. So if we go back 30 years, that's 4 gens, 1990.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably where the intellectual capital in cycling started to change, because it suddenly got professional. There were more races. The teams expanded in size. There was more data collected in the race, heart rate initially, power output later on. And I suspect that data has accelerated development, because now a young rider doesn't need to learn from 6,000 kilometers of racing. He can learn in 600 Ks what he might have learned in 6,000 before, because the intensity and the volume of quality information that he gets is so much greater. Yeah.
Just pop onto Zwift and see what his average wattage
is. Indoor riding. I mean, these guys have never had the opportunity to learn so much so quickly as they do now. So plus there's more races. They're looking after the guys, I think, better in teams, because they now recognize their assets. You know, like, it's a business now. And so if you're paying a guy 200 a year, you better keep him healthy and look after him. So someone's paid now to manage that data and develop the guy. So the only thing really that has to be acquired over time is now tactical nous and skill. That's the one thing data can't always help you with. But they have so many opportunities to race, because the sport has gotten bigger.
Yeah.
And you get these kids from Europe who are learning how to do that from their early teens. And so you chuck a guy into his first tour in his early 20s and he fits in. So I think that's probably the main reason for it. But it's an interesting phenomenon for sure.
Well, we're watching the World Championships, of course, coming up this weekend with great deal of interest to see who is going to be the winner of that one. Should we have a little quick side bet on the winner of the World Champs on Sunday?
Well, the interesting question is, and I've heard this in your second favorite podcast, is they've had a big debate over whether the World Champs can be won by a guy who was in the race or not.
Yes.
Because that's a hell of a turnaround from a hard tour 1 week later to do what is a unbelievably tough World Championship course.
Yeah, a lot of hills.
I mean, it's just did I see correctly, 5,000 meters of climbing?
I haven't checked, to be honest with you. I just know it's a lot of climbing.
It's mad. It's huge numbers.
Yeah.
260K, 5,000 meters. If you've got any residual fatigue, you are done after three climbs. Yeah. It's crazy.
So potentially a rider who wasn't racing hard on the Tour de France or was taking it easy in the last week.
Exactly.
I was going to go Julien Alaphilippe, but he was looking a bit knackered at the end of the Tour de France. So maybe not the one to look out for.
Yeah, but I mean, who else? Who else is
the strongest team? The Italians are always strong. The Brits.
It's a home race for them.
Yeah.
I mean,
maybe Aru was just faking it at the Tour de France and just preparing for the World Champs.
The problem these guys have all got is, like, they've got the carapace problem. It doesn't matter how easy you go in the first two thirds.
Yes.
If you just don't have the legs, it doesn't matter, because the other guy's going to kill you anyway at the end.
Yeah.
And so I would go, I mean, how's this for boring? I'm going to say Slovenia wins it.
Okay, so either Roglic or Roglic.
Yeah, because I just don't think there's anyone not from the tour with the caliber to beat even a tired tour rider at that level.
Yeah.
About who knows?
Yeah. I'm gonna take a flyer at Geraint Thomas. I think he did a ride at the Adriana.
Tirana Adriatica.
Tirana Adriatica. Yeah, I think he was second there, and I think he's got a chance, and
if he does that, the
Palmares to suggest he's competitive.
But if he does that, the howls from the British fans will just intensify, like, about how he should have been the team leader of the tour. It's interesting to one.
Exactly.
I don't think either he or I don't think Froome would have made the top 50 at the tour, and Thomas might have made top 10, but not top 5.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah,
based on where they were in the Dauphiné, and although then again, I mean, we've seen that team produce miracle transformations before, so who knows. Yeah.
Well, we're watching with a great deal of interest. But thank you to all of you that got involved with us on Twitter. Of course, Sports Side Pod is our Twitter handle. And big thank you to our Patreon supporters who have been donating over the weekend. We got three new ones.
I was just reminding you that you'd asked me for my three take-home signs and we'd only done two.
Okay, I'll give me your third one.
And my third one, I just want to make this, was just this final point about COVID. Because so many people said that this race will not make it to Paris. And every single day, people were freaking out about the fans on the side of the road and how dangerous this was and blah, blah, blah. They tested everyone associated with the race twice. You know, so between 700 and 800 tests every Monday in the tour, four positives in week one, zero in week two. And that, for me, you know, when we did our COVID-19 podcast, we were saying that sport has opportunities to control the virus more than many other domains because it is such a bubble, and you can protect the bubble better than a restaurant or a hotel or whatever can. And I think the tour proved that. Obviously, they took major precautions to defend that bubble, and we saw a lot of that. Some stages without fans, the masks on the podium, no handshakes, all the interviews. But it shows that it can be done. And I think it's a very cool lesson for people to not panic about every little thing. Like, we need to now say, if the tour can make it 3,500 kilometers around France, yeah, then other sports need to find a way, because there's a way to do this. And the tour was actually extremely successful. ASO did a hell of a while to get it done. There's a few things that you could argue with. But let's say that this was a success, a COVID-19 success story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, shout out to the organizers for sure.
And I'm glad that we only had to talk about it for 5 minutes every 2 weeks and it wasn't the talking point. And I hope and I expect that that will be the same thing. And remember, France wasn't exactly dormant with respect to this disease. I mean, they were having a spike in cases, and yet still you can do this thing. So let's hope the Vuelta and the Giro get the same success and then move on. Like, let's get sport back now.
Yeah, it was certainly a relief to see the Tour de France happening this year. And for those of you that enjoy cycling or any kind of endurance sport, it's lovely to see the return of it on our TV screens. And if you were able to watch it on the route, even more amazing that must have been. But until next time, from us, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.